Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The state of Wisconsin and Taiwanese tech company Foxconn struck a new deal for a scaled-back project in Mount Pleasant. A bipartisan assembly task force released 18 policing recommendations that stopped short of banning no-knock warrants and the use of chokeholds in all cases. And the statewide elections for the 2022 cycle have started to take shape as another Republican entered the attorney general race. Rewind, your week in review for April 23rd.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Foxconn is eligible for up to $80 million in a new deal officials with the company struck with the state this week. The new contract offers incentives if Foxconn develops a, quote, high-tech manufacturing ecosystem within its campus. Foxconn could get up to $80 million in credits for producing 1,454 qualified jobs and investing $672 million in the southeastern Wisconsin site. The original contract now stood at $2.85 billion, and it included $1.5 billion for the creation of 13,000 jobs and up to $1.35 billion for capital investments totaling $10 billion. That contract also had an end date of December 31st, 2032, while the new one ends 6 years sooner. It is worth noting that Foxconn earned no tax incentives under the first deal. The state told Foxconn in the fall it would need to renegotiate to be eligible because the project scope had changed. The first contract specifically stipulated Foxconn would create a Generation 10.5 facility to produce LCD screens for large screen TVs and things like that. But prior to that, negotiations had stopped and started over a number of years. Of course, what Foxconn would actually create sort of became a bit of a moving target over those conversations as well. JR, how did we get to this point of a renegotiated deal?
Well, part of it's economic, part of it's political. Let's look at the political piece first. When Foxconn first announced this deal in 2017 with the state, it made sense because you had President Trump in office. He was threatening a trade war with China at the time. It just happened to go in a swing state that was important to Trump's reelection prospects. Just happened to be in the district of the then House Speaker, Paul Ryan, also the district of then Speaker and still Speaker, Robin Voss, and with Governor Scott Walker, who looked at this as a way that was going to really boost his reelection efforts. So politically, you can't ignore that piece of it in the economics of it, because economically, I mean, like I've been saying, I took Econ 201 in college. Even I understand, like, labor costs, supply and demand. The labor costs of building a flat screen factory like this in the United States are just much higher than they are somewhere else in the world. But it gave Foxconn a beachhead in North America with all these things going on politically that it made sense. But the market began to change quickly, where the economics made less and less sense. Politically, things have changed. Remember, Scott Walker lost in 2018, Donald Trump lost in 2020, and you had a Governor Evers saying, look, you originally promised this Generation 10 facility, which was going to be transformational, right? It wasn't just about the facility itself. It was about the spinoffs that we expected that were going to happen because of how transformational this project was going to be. That project was never, once it wasn't going to be Generation 10, it was never going to be the transformational project they envisioned it to be, and it began to contract what it could impact the economy. So now we have what the Evers folks call right-sizing the contract to reflect what Foxconn is or what it might be going forward. And there are a couple benefits here for the company. One, there's much lower credits it can attain from the state, the intense glare might go away now. It might get away from this, what's it making, the constant question of what's it doing. It's been profiled and reprofiled in numerous national locations for not living to its promises. That might now die down. You have investors who are worried that, look, you guys have an issue there with Governor Evers saying that this is not meeting requirements. What's going on? That's taken care of now. Everybody kind of take a deep breath, and Foxconn can make ventilators or electric cars or widgets. As long as they produce the jobs they promised, the intense pressure dies down compared to what's faced for the last several years.
In a way, both sides, politically speaking, got something out of it, right? Governor Evers was able to say, look, taxpayers, I saved you $2.77 billion. Of course, people would note that The tax incentives haven't been paid out yet and probably wouldn't under the deal, which is something Republicans would note then, too, is, look, the original contract worked the way we wanted it to. The company never got, it didn't make the, it didn't meet the job threshold, it didn't meet the investment thresholds, and therefore it didn't qualify for tax incentives like the deal intended. How does that dynamic play out going forward, JR? And do you think that impacts, that rhetoric will impact statewide races in the future?
Well, good question. But when, with the GOP talking point about that contract and the safeguards, remember, the state and local taxpayers and ratepayers have already paid out $1 billion around Foxconn. No matter what happened with this contract, that money is in place because I-94 north-south expanded to 8 lanes in Racine County. There's infrastructure put in place around the plant. The local governments took out bonds to help pay for its share of this project. Ratepayers paid for a high-voltage line to run to the facility. I mean, there are costs no matter what. And two, the Evers folks, even though that they had said you didn't qualify Foxconn because you're falling short of the contract, there's always a possibility of a lawsuit from Foxconn saying, yes, we did. You take the lawsuit option off the table now, and again, that intensity dies down. Now, going forward politically, it depends. I mean, there are various people who think that Foxconn may end up being a loser for Scott Walker in 2018. I can recall conversations in 2017 with Republican operatives telling me that Scott Walker had sealed the deal for his reelection. This was going to be it. He was going to win no matter what because he signed this massive contract. Obviously did not happen. Became, some people would say, somewhat of an albatross around him outstate. For Governor Evers, what's interesting is this contract runs through the end of 2025. The report from Foxconn to detail how many jobs it created in that calendar year is due in April of 2026. Governor Evers hasn't said for sure he's going to run in 2022, though we expect him to. Let's just say Governor Evers wins re-election in 2022. He's not looking to run for a third term. By the time this deal is kind of the final chapter is written, he will be well on his way toward leaving the governor's office, and it could be somebody else's issue. So, I mean, the determination from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, those credits will be sometime in summer to fall of 2026, and Governor Evers, again, is months away from, best case scenario for him, winning a second term, leaving office, and going off in retirement. So I don't know this is going to make or break him or anybody else going forward, because other than Walker, nobody's really associated with the project. Paid a price. Paul Ryan retired. Robin Voss is a huge backer. He got reelected overwhelmingly last fall. So there's nobody else really left to worry about this in terms of like their political future.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear now from WEDC's Secretary and CEO, Missy Hughes, who spoke on our Newsmakers event this week.
Well, what we're really seeing is a contract that's right-sized to the project. One of the challenges with the previous agreement where there were little or no caps on the amount of dollars that Foxconn could achieve over 15 years. And so it's important that we are able to really calculate, okay, what's our potential tax burden that we need to support with this company? And so now we have 6 years. And that's really critical. It was also important to Foxconn because, again, Foxconn is looking for flexibility. They're in a really dynamic marketplace. And so we collectively agreed with Foxconn, let's take a little bite here and let's work on some wins. Let's have some success and performance. And, we do have a process where you can amend the agreement and we can work through, as Foxconn grows, hopefully, continues to grow in that area, we'll be able to support that growth. And what Foxconn is really good at is making things for other people. So they're looking around the marketplace and saying, look, we've got this great facility in Southeast Wisconsin. We want to build things for you. What can we work on?
A task force seeking to combat Wisconsin's racial disparities has released 18 recommendations surrounding policing. The recommendations from the Law Enforcement Policies and Standards Subcommittee don't include, though, a total ban on the use of chokeholds or no-knock warrants, as Governor Tony Evers wants. The report calls for law enforcement agencies at the local level to post their use of force policies online. Drug and alcohol testing officers who shoot or cause, quote, great bodily harm to an individual, requiring all patrolling active duty officers to wear body cameras, and making it a crime for officers not to intervene if a colleague is using inappropriate levels of force. Separately, Governor Evers directed state law enforcement agencies like Capitol Police and the State Patrol to update their use of force policies to bar chokeholds except as a last resort. The task force's work so far has been bookended, right, by the Kenosha police shooting of Jacob Blake in the summer and the jury this week finding former Minneapolis cop Derek Chauvin guilty of murder in murdering George Floyd. But when digging into recommendations, not a lot of new ground is really covered in these topics. So getting these measures passed will largely be contingent on task force members going to bill authors and recommending or asking them to amend their bills to reflect the latest recommendations. Do you see that process playing out successfully in the months ahead, JR, for the task force?
Well, let's give the Assembly credit. It likes its task forces. We've seen a lot of them under Speaker Robin Voss. They produce a lot of legislation with buy-in from various parties. The issue has been getting the Senate to then buy in to what's proposed by these task forces. Look at the Water Quality Task Force a couple of years ago. Those bills largely didn't get through the Senate because of questions about costs and other things. Now you have a competing package that Senator Van Wongard, Senator Alberta Darling, both Republicans, some input from Senator Leader Taylor, a Democrat from Milwaukee, put together. What I'm watching is how do the bills that those guys worked on mesh with the task force recommendations. And I was told by one Senate aide this week, you know, Republicans in the Senate will take their cues from Wongard, a former police officer. He's already raised concerns about one bill, which would create some penalties, or one proposal, I should say, which would create penalties for unnecessarily summoning a police officer. He's got an issue with that. If he's got an issue with it, guess that the Senate Republicans will have an issue with it, and that position won't get done. But again, watch how what he's proposed with Darling and Taylor meshes with this task force to see what really the roadmap is for these bills going forward.
And for his part, Governor Evers certainly doesn't seem impressed by the recommendations. He told reporters that he was frustrated that a task force was created to recommend similar things to recommendations he had already put forth. Recall that over the summer, last summer, Governor Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes put forward a slate of 10 or so bills regarding policing changes, banning the use of chokeholds and no-knock warrants, and many of those elements, right, were considered by the task force and factored into its recommendations. Evers said, quote, "My frustration is that all this could have been taken care of a long time ago." But you go ask the task force co-chairs, like I did this week, about sort of that in anticipation of that kind of pushback, and they'll say, sure, we reviewed the existing recommendations, but in a lot of cases, we went deeper and we did propose new measures. We broke new ground. For example, one thing they point to is there are bills that exist or that have been floated in the state that would require officers who view one of their colleagues using an excessive amount of force to intervene, to report it to a higher up, and then have basically whistleblower protections in place to ensure that individual does not face any blowback for doing that. These bills, these recommendations would go a bit further in that it would make it a crime then for an officer not to intervene and you know, tell a higher up and also ensure that when a colleague, if a colleague is using inappropriate levels of force, that practice continues. So there's a lot of different elements at play here, JR. Anything else to add on this topic?
Well, don't forget when Governor Evers put forward his proposals last summer, he didn't bring in Republican lawmakers to get their input before he put them out. And this is the frustration Republicans have with Governor Evers, that there isn't really a two-way street in terms of proposals. He's frustrated that they don't consult him to get stuff done. They're frustrated that he doesn't bring them in before doing things. So this is why you have a situation like this.
All right. We're a year and a half out from the statewide 2022 general elections, but it's never too early to start talking about them. This week in the Attorney General's race, for example, we have a new entrant that sets up a Republican primary as two candidates look to take on Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat. The new addition is UW-Madison Professor Ryan Owens. Also in the race is Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney, both Republicans. For U.S. Senate, Senator Ron Johnson has yet to say whether he will seek a third term for office. In the meantime, four Democrats have officially announced campaigns. Dr. Jillian Bettino, a radiologist, Sarah Godlewski, the state treasurer, Alex Lazary, a Milwaukee Box executive, and Tom Nelson, an Outagamie County executive. Sarah Godlewski was the most recent to announce. She launched her campaign last week. In the race for governor, we have no Republican candidates yet officially declare, But we do know that potential gubernatorial candidates are also eyeing what Ron Johnson does before they make a decision, at least on the Republican side, of course. We have Kevin Nicholson, a former U.S. Senate candidate, who has said he'll run for U.S. Senator Governor. And, of course, there's no shortage of other names being considered. Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, of course, is highly expected to get into the race. Other candidates include Eric Hovde, a Madison businessman, former Congressman Sean Duffy, maybe Bill McCosken, I suppose, Congressman Mike Gallagher, which could set up an interesting, you know, primary for his congressional seat. Senate President Roger Roth, for example, former Senate President Roger Roth could get into that. Maybe State Senator Andre Jacques. It really does set off a domino effect when we see these other candidates considering. But anyway, JR, when in this gubernatorial field will we start to see officially Republicans get into the race? And how dependent are those decisions on what happens with Senator Ron Johnson?
Well, kind of going theories that we're going to start seeing more announcements from gubernatorial candidates after the budget. Rebecca Clayfish is all but in. She's created an organization to a PAC to give money to their candidates. She's got a think tank, which, quite frankly, is a campaign in waiting. It's kind of how campaigns work anymore. You form a think tank, you talk about ideas, and the people who work for the think tank just happen to go work for your campaign down the road, which is totally legal. Bill McCosken is likely only in the gubernatorial lane if he decides to run for something. Then you have a lot of candidates who kind of like have a foot in both fields. Now, on the governor's side, you know, Chris Capia, Senate President, Paul Farrell, Washington County Executive. I mean, the kind of list goes on of people who might run for governor. On the U.S. Senate side, we're all waiting to see what Ron Johnson does, because if he runs again, that closes off that avenue for Republican candidates who can run statewide, and they might look at the governor's race. If Ron Johnson doesn't run, then you have people like Kevin Nicholson, who ran for Senate in 2018, Mike Gallagher, Congressman from Green Bay, Sean Duffy, former congressman, Reince Priebus, former state and Republican national chairman. You know, his name's been mentioned for the governor's race, but talking to people, we all think that he's more interested in running for U.S. Senate, and talking about governor gets his name floating around, right? There's this kind of play you're going to watch, because Ron Johnson, he may take until early next year, even next spring, to make his formal announcement what he's going to do. You know, and I've heard people talk about May of this year, January of next year, spring of next year, because Ron Johnson, remember, in 2010, didn't formally announce until the spring, ran a very well-run campaign for that short sprint, and pulled off the upset over Russ Feingold. In Ron Johnson's mind, people tell me, the same thing can happen again. You don't have to have a long, drawn-out primary. But for a person like Kevin Nicholson, for example, he wants to run for U.S. Senate, we think. I mean, that's really where his heart is, but if that's not there, he might run for governor. How does Kevin Nicholson approach it if it gets to be fall this year, for example, and Johnson hasn't announced? Might Nicholson announce for governor? And then if Johnson gets out, switch to the U.S. Senate, how can he pull that off? That could be kind of a little interesting. Gallagher, we think, for example, also wants to run for U.S. Senate if Johnson's not there. He's talked about running for governor, but we don't think his heart's really in that. Gallagher is in a good position that he can keep raising money for his congressional campaign, and if Johnson doesn't run, flip the switch and jump into that race. So there's all kinds of moving pieces right now for the dynamic of those two races, and really it's all linchpin is Ron Johnson. What is Ron going to do, and when is he going to do it?
And, of course, the Democratic side for U.S. Senate, we're already seeing the makings right of what will be a crowded primary. A couple other candidates are also considering to get in the race. What do you think the timing is for that, and when will we see sort of the makings of a full primary field on the Democratic side?
So, like Ron Johnson is kind of like the real key piece in the Republican side. In that Democratic Senate race, the key piece is Mandela Barnes, Lieutenant Governor. What is he going to do? The going theory is he won't make a decision until after the budget is done, because as Lieutenant Governor, one of his main jobs is to be a cheerleader for what the governor is proposing, and the budget is the biggest bill that they're talking about this year. So he's got that in front of him. After that is done, sometime this summer, we all hope, those of us summer plans, he can have some time to kind of lay groundwork or get into the Senate race. If he gets in, he changed the dynamic of that race quite a bit, because he's from Milwaukee, has good connections to groups in Madison, whereas you can kind of see the lanes already of Lazary is like the Milwaukee candidate, Galuski trying to be more of the Madison candidate, maybe a little bit outstate audience, and Tom Nelson's more of the kind of insurgent running, you know, outstate campaign. But Mandela would be a key in how those dynamics shape up. You also have State Senator Chris Larson from Milwaukee talk about running, Stephen Olcara from the Action Project talk about running. So there are a lot of names floating. what I'm watching is once this budget is done and push comes to shove, who gets in and raises the money, builds the operation, have a credible campaign.
Let's move on to our COVID update this week. More than 4 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been administered in Wisconsin this week. Governor Evers and the Department of Health Services also announced on Tuesday the state has received over $175 million in federal money to create a program to bolster COVID-19 testing for students and staff in schools. Evers has also said that $420 million from the latest COVID federal package will be used to give grants to small businesses harmed by the pandemic. Separately, UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee chancellors have again pledged that students, faculty, and staff would not be required to get COVID-19 vaccines ahead of the new school year to return to campus. Let's hear now from DHS Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke on vaccine administration in Wisconsin and the gap between supply and demand here.
As of today, we have administered 4,057,602 doses of COVID-19 vaccine in our state. 4 million doses down and about another 3 million doses to go to reach 80% community immunity. We still have had more requests for vaccine than we have vaccine available to order from the federal government. But the gap is closing. As supply and demand get closer together in terms of our distribution to vaccinators, it'll go back to some system similar to how it was in the beginning, where vaccinators could generally depend upon getting whatever vaccine they requested. And our strategy of reaching out to people will change too, because it will be more targeted. It will be more focused on finding the folks who have not yet received a vaccine, inviting them to consider the opportunity to have a vaccine, and moving away from larger community-based clinics to smaller clinics in community, making it really easy for people to get a vaccine.
Let's move on to stock picks now. What's rising this week, JR?
Andrea Palm, the former Department of Health Services Secretary in Wisconsin, was nominated to be Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services from the Biden administration. Like, there are Republicans who are unhappy about how she handled COVID-19 restrictions in Wisconsin under the direction of Governor Tony Evers. A pair of U.S. Congressmen, Tom Tiffany from up north and Scott Fitzgerald from Milwaukee suburbs, had sent a letter to the U.S. Senate members of the Finance Committee saying, don't confirm this person. We have issues here. Her term in Wisconsin was a failure. Didn't get very far. This week, the Finance Committee voted 20-8 to back her nomination. Next step is a full floor vote. And she even got props from the ranking Senate Republican on that committee, saying that he was going to support her nomination because she pledged to work with Republicans on Medicaid. Looks like she's in, barring some last second like discovery or issue, she's on a glide path toward confirmation, and those Republican hopes of derailing that nomination are pretty much dashed.
A very different story from where she was at the state level, where there had been talks, right, leading up to January and her appointment to the Biden administration of, you know, plans for a floor vote to vote her down.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she had great timing to get the job when she did. Now, it was interesting. Republicans did not take the opportunity that they had during the course of the summer and fall of last year to try and vote that nomination. But the point made to me was that it would look really bad during a pandemic to fire the state's top health officer, so they'd held off. And it was pretty clear right around the holidays this year that she was in line for by an appointment that she was going to get out of town because there's no point sticking around here with that kind of hostility in the state Senate.
That's right. What's mixed this week, JR?
So Ryan Owens, we mentioned he's going to run for attorney general. Like, you have two Republican candidates for attorney general who both have an issue. One is that Ryan Owens has never been a prosecutor. And look, the Department of Justice in Wisconsin is not a crime-fighting outfit per se. It is one of the state's largest law firms, handles all kinds of cases on all kinds of things. But voters have shown they like a person who has some kind of prosecutorial experience to be the state's quote-unquote top cop. So that's Owens' challenge. How does he address that lack of experience? Now, in an interview with me last week, he said that it is principles, not positions, that matter in this race. We'll see. We'll see if voters look past that, and you're going to see him run as a kind of a conservative crusader defend the Constitution and stand shoulder to shoulder conservatives, and that's going to be his pitch. Eric Toney, the Fond du Lac County DA, has also announced he drew a line in the sand this week, saying that he looks forward to contrast these experiences of him, you know, he has an Owen, Professor Owens, he called him, in the classroom versus his experience as a prosecutor. And that's Tony's pitch, right? He's going to say that, look, this guy hasn't done the job. He's not up to the task. Tony's issue, however, is that he filed charges that were later dropped against 10 people in Fallon County for violating Governor Evers' stay-at-home order in place back in March of last year. Now, at the time, it may have made sense. It may have been the right thing to do. They're based on complaints the office received from what I read in media reports. But that has become a red-hot topic with the GOP base. And Tony also has to do a good job messaging that issue to get past that with the base. Now, fast forward to November. Josh calls now formally says he's going to run for election. We all expect him to. In talking to people, even if these guys both have some kind of flaw as a candidate for AG, there's a good guess that the national winds blowing next fall will dictate who wins the AG's office. We had a reputation as a ticket-splitting state years ago that has slowly evaporated. You know, never mind 2018 when there are 150,000 Tammy Baldwin, Scott Walker voters. Not sure who those people are, but that said, typically, top-of-ticket races match pretty closely in Wisconsin. Tony Evers and Josh Call within like a half point of each other, percentage-wise, what they won in those races. You're going to have a U.S. Senate race next year, which is going to be extremely expensive. A governor's race, also quite expensive. So how do the candidates for AG break through that clutter and kind of create a name for themselves ahead of 2022? It could be a challenge. Now, a caveat, however, that terror calculation is we have an example in 2006 where it was a Democratic wave year. I think Jim Doyle won re-election as governor by like 5.5 points or so. Herb Kohl won re-election by 38 points in his Senate race. And yet Republican J.B. Van Hollen won the AG's race that year, beating Kathleen Falk for an open seat. Now, a couple of caveats to that story, though. Kathleen Falk had not been a prosecutor. That was one of the hangups that she got hit on. Also, WMC and other business groups knocked her for wanting to be, in their words, environmental activist in the AG's role. And on top of all that, she had challenged incumbent Peg Lautenschlager in the Democratic primary. Peg had won the AG's office in 2002. She had driven a state car into a ditch under the influence during her term. There were concerns that she couldn't win because of that incident. There seemed to be some issues with the Democratic base for Falk taking on Lautenschlager in that primary. Now, that all said, there's an example where a ticket splitting and experience seem to matter in an AG's race. Will it matter again next fall? We could find out.
The only other example of ticket splitting I think you and I could come up with in recent history was all the way back to the Tommy Thompson administration when, future governor, then attorney general, Democrat Jim Doyle won the AG's race. But yeah, that's as we've just discussed, that's a different era, right, in Wisconsin politics.
That is ancient history. I'm not going to mention where you were in life in 1998, the last time that Jim Doyle and Tommy Thompson won a race in the same ticket.
Moving swiftly along, what's falling this week, JR?
So GOP spending priorities. Look, Governor Evers vetoed his 11 bills to dictate how the federal money is spent from the latest COVID package. It's not a surprise. The question now is, how do Republicans message this, right? Because they were portraying this as their priorities that they said reflected what the people wanted. There are things like a $1 billion property tax rebate for people that they believe are politically popular. So how do they message this? Now, the challenge for lawmakers anytime in dispute with the governor is the governor has a bigger bully pulpit. It's just natural with the office. And number two, Evers has vetoed these bills, and now he's going to keep handing out money from now until who knows when it's all used up, right? I mean, the same day he vetoes 11 bills, he announces $420 million for small businesses. There is an example of how Evers can use that bully pulpit to kind of highlight what he wants to do and brush aside what Republicans had called for. So, you know, you'll see some messaging going on, but it's going to be tough for Republicans to kind of overcome the natural advantage the governor has in trying to portray how his money is going to be spent. And oh, by the way, report out this morning from Wisconsin Policy Forum, between the multiple federal packages, Wisconsin's getting like $20 billion, with a B, dollars, for state and local governments, including schools. From that, doesn't include the billions, again with a B, for Wisconsin residents and businesses through stimulus checks that we've received. So it's a lot of money flowing to the state of Wisconsin.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for April 23rd.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.